Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. This week's episode focuses on environmental challenges facing India. Over 1 billion people live in India, and the environmental challenges facing the country today are really daunting. In this hour, we'll hear from author and journalist Meera Subramanian. The program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Linda Calhoun. She's a trustee of the World Affairs Council.
So, Meera, I'd like to start our conversation tonight by having you give our audience in some broad brushstrokes a view of some of the serious ecological challenges that are facing India.
Yeah, there's no shortage of them. They're dealing with lacks on a pretty monumental level. I think we tend to hear about India's economic boom, especially over the last 20 years. We hear about the IT technology that's happening. We hear about big houses in Bombay and movie stars, but the numbers are a little more sobering in terms of the realities of what kind of development lags they have. So there's 60% are without access to clean water, and a quarter don't have electricity, and two-thirds of Indian households are using open fires for at least part of their energy needs every day. So you've got some huge portions of humanity, right? This is a fifth of the world's, of the planet's humanity is in India right now. And so looking at those numbers, they're big, so there's a lot of lacks. And so how are people facing and trying to resolve some of those problems?
And if you will, can you give us a little bit more of the backstory of how we got to this point? You know, how these challenges developed over time? You know, what were some of the political, economic, and demographic changes and shifts that have brought us to this juncture?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a combination of, definitely the growing population in India is colliding with the natural resource limitations. It's not that big a country, and yet, like we're saying, a fifth of humanity in this small space. So that has been a growing problem. And even when India became independent in 1947, they were very aware of, for example, food shortages. They were highly dependent on imports in 1947, and they knew that they had a growing population, and they were very actively trying to figure out how do we prevent, you know, the Bengal famines that happened in the early 1940s that killed millions of people. So there have been awareness of a lot of those issues, but also just a struggle to keep up. Even places like, you look at like Delhi's building a subway system, great, totally great, but as soon as it's full, there's more people. So there's kind of a catch-up game that's constantly in process.
And now I'd like to just focus on you personally for a second. You're an environmental journalist, and what was the specific trigger that made you want to devote your focus on this field of inquiry?
Yeah, it's actually been kind of fascinating how many things unfold as you're working on a book that you don't even realize were present as you started the process. I had done nonprofit work in the environmental field in the U.S. throughout my 20s and 30s before I kind of switched gears and went to journalism school in my early 30s to try to write those same stories. And then as I was working on the book, I was looking at organic agriculture, and I'm looking at fuel-efficient, clean wood cook stoves as a response to that question about burning open biomass. And I realized, oh, this is like the same work I've been doing since I was 24 years old. And it was a lot of just an evolution of looking at the same topic but coming at it from really different angles. And then my father is from India, so I've gone to India all my life, just as a half-daughter of India, of going there to visit family. And each time I would go, I was a little different, you know, just growing up. And then India was going through these rapid changes. So I'd see, like, all these things that changed and all these things that didn't. And when I was trying to live sustainably in my 20s, in rural Oregon, I was transfixed by all the, like, ways that they were living, you know, simply, which was really that was a forced situation. But gleaning that, trying to figure out what we can learn from them instead of always just thinking about what we can teach a place like that.
And was there, can you look on a sort of an aha moment when you knew you were going to be a journalist and you were going to focus on environmental issues and that was going to be your life's work from that point.
I was working in the nonprofit field, and I think maybe two little things. I was becoming like kind of interested in. I kind of had the idea that you were either born a writer or you weren't. And if you weren't just born a writer and just doing that, then all hope was over. And finally, it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I started thinking, well, maybe you can go to a school and they can teach you how to be a better writer. Maybe it's just not this God-given skill. And so that was one little aha moment. And then I've read Harper's Magazine for years, and I started reading about, one story covered my friends in rural Oregon. And I'm like, oh, like the rest of the world cares what we're doing out here with these like sustainability issues. Like there's actually, because I was doing it because I cared about it deeply in that context, kind of on a more just a personal level. And I wasn't thinking about these larger global implications as much, I think. So trying to translate that to like, how can I bring all these things together and write? I felt constrained within the nonprofit world of being able to write there, but in a little bit more of a black and white way. And I felt like the stories were way more messy and complicated, and that was where the interesting writing was to be done.
And I know that, so you went to graduate school later, and you just started getting published in your early 30s, right?
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about that story of how getting articles out and being well-known and published in environmental circles led to you being able to do that book?
Right. It is just a process of one thing building on the other. I've swore I was going to quit a million times. Being a freelance journalist is really, really hard financially. Right when I went into grad school was 2004-05, and as soon as I get there, they're like, oh, the entire publishing world is collapsing on itself. And the model was changing by the day, and it still is. And so there were a few years there where it just seemed really dire, and then there was a shift where new models of journalism started emerging, and it suddenly felt hopeful again. In terms of the building on the clips, I loved what I learned in graduate school of that there's like a real meritocracy within journalism. Like you need to write good, interesting stories, and you need to do it well, and you don't need anything else, and you have to keep proving yourself. They also warned us that it's not like we are ever going to be attorneys where we get to sit back and reap the rewards while other people do the work. No, we have to keep doing that meritocracy thing like all the way till we die. but NYU was an amazing place to go to grad school because they were bringing editors in. So one of my first clips was from the New York Times because I was in that location, because I was really fortunate to be able to pitch directly to a New York Times editor as a graduate student. But I felt like I also got a lot out of grad school because I was older and I'd been out and working and I knew what I cared about and wanted to write about, and that felt like that was something that was really helpful to me compared to some of my other grad student friends who were, 24 and they were still just figuring it out, and I'm like, I know what I want to write about, like teach me how to do it. I was really hungry for that.
That's great. Doing the proposal for this book, how did it come together for you, and basically why did you step out and say, all right, I've had success with my writing in publications, but now I've got a story to tell in a book form?
Yeah, that's, and again, behind every success are like dozens of failures, so.
You can talk a little bit about those.
So I worked on a book proposal about peregrine falcons and the return of peregrine falcons in the U.S., which is an amazing, successful conservation story in North America. And I followed the biologist around New York who was monitoring the nest sites. I went cross country. I had like maybe half of a book written, and I had a proposal, and I was trying to shop it around in the crash of 2008, and nobody was interested in some book about peregrine falcons. And so I spent literally years on a failed book proposal that still has yet to see the light of day. Meanwhile, I had a Kashmiri journalist friend that I was in my house in Brooklyn, and he kept writing, he could care less about the birds. I'd be talking about the falcons. He could care less. And he's like, write about people. And I had always wanted to write about India, just having that personal connection. And in 2004 or 5, I learned that there was this catastrophic decline of vultures happening in India. So I was focused on the falcons. Once you're in the bird world, it taps
into birds of prey.
Everything.
Sticking together, yeah.
Stick together. And so I was, hearing from biologists, yeah, something's going on in India. The vultures are just dying out. Catastrophic decline, 99% of the population gone in 10 years. They were still trying to figure out what it was. So I got completely intrigued with that story and did a couple small pieces completely remotely. I'd still yet to lay eyes on a vulture and did a couple small pieces and then ended up finally doing a large piece for Virginia Quarterly Review that gave me the space to write, you know, a 10,000-word story and go to India and meet the biologists who were trying to do conservation breeding and meet the biologists who were going out and surveying cliffs and nest sites and meet the Parsis who are dealing with a failed death ritual of a sky burial where they lay out their dead for the vultures to consume and the vultures are not there anymore. So I, all of a sudden, there was like, here's a way to take this one tiny ecological crisis, and it's got all these ramifications. It's not just ecological, it's religious, it's cultural. Feral dogs were stepping in where the niche of all the livestock that used to be consumed by the vultures, the dead livestock, was now not being consumed, and dogs were, population was booming. So there's all these different ways that one environmental crisis that you would think nobody would care about. Oh, vultures are gone. Oh, that's terrible. We don't get to see them like with their head in a carcass on the side of the road. It's, this is a blessing, right? And the answer was no, it's not. And yeah. so that story actually got some nice attention and made me also kind of like reading that Harper's piece, like, oh, people care about this. And then I just jumped on the momentum of that and wrote a book proposal for this book based on the vultures as a starting point.
That's great. And just to give people a little more insight into why corpses or vultures are used to dispose of corpses, could you just explain
that
with the Parsi? The
Parsis are a small religious group that are mostly based in Mumbai now, and they descend from the Zoroastrians that came from Persia. And they basically believe that that earth is sacred and fire is sacred and a dead body is a polluting substance. And so a sky burial is the way that they have done this for literally for thousands of years to lay out their dead and the vultures consuming them and having the bodies exposed to sun and the wild was basically the cleanest method for disposal for them.
So we understand how the extinction would be very upending for that. And so your book, how has it been received in India? Have you...
I'm so curious to know. It's actually coming
out. It
came out in August here.
Okay.
It comes out actually, I think, next week in India. It's the same book. It's under the title Elemental India there, but it's the same book. And I'll be going to India in January to talk about it there, like I'm doing here now. So I'm actually really curious to see how India will respond, if it'll be a different response or I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah, because I one of the reasons I wanted to know that is at the end of the month, everyone knows the world will convene in Paris with the Conference of Parties, COP for the UN Conference on Climate Change, to further climate diplomacy and create a new agreement to succeed the Kyoto Protocol. And I was wondering how you saw your book helping to inform those discussions for your readers and then perhaps for participants.
That would be great. Maybe I can get the book into the hands of the delegates before they go.
Why not?
If anybody out there can help me do that. I do hope it becomes a greater part of the discussion because there is so much focus on filling those developmental gaps that we were talking about earlier that I really think India does have an opportunity to develop with a new model. That the technology is there and they could bring together the best of traditional knowledge of how Indians survived in South Asia with their climate, with their terrain, with their water resources for so long and combine that with the best of the technology that's coming from Silicon Valley and all these amazing startups and renewable advances, et cetera, that could create a new model of development that could happen, but it's really hard to see whether India's going to embrace that.
Yeah, and let's, you know, dive a little deeper into that, because this next question I have for you is, what are some of the lessons learned and best practices that India has to share with the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's what I went to India to try to find. Like, I trying to write a book about the environment in India is a daunting and potentially really depressing task. So I tried to zero in on specific stories about individuals that were really trying to tackle head-on problems that they were facing in their own communities. And what I found was often it was very small-scale answers, and I found people who really believed that they had the power to be changing things within their own lives, and it was taking effect. So there was just a lot of surprising, hopeful stories that I found coming out of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you traveled all over the country. How did you get your entree into all these different communities and locales? I mean, when you see the map of the terrain that you covered, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. I should have had one of those little, like, pedometers on me or something to figure out how many miles I traversed. But there was it was amazing how much didn't make it into the book. And I still feel like, oh, I didn't get to tell, you know, that person's story or that person's. I look through the pictures and I look through my notes still, and I'm just like, oh, there's just so many. I met so many amazing people who were doing so many things. But in terms of just trying to focus in on some specific individuals and really give the reader a chance to get to know them a little better, and what drives them and what's working for them and what's not working for them, I just had to zero in on certain people. But it was really just a matter of asking everybody and doing a lot of research and going down every single rabbit hole. And a bunch of them ended up being dead ends, or once I got there, I just wasn't impressed with what I was seeing. What I saw was totally different than what I thought that I was going to see, which is the fascinating and fun part of being a journalist, is that sometimes the stories play out the way you think they're going to, and many times they don't. And sometimes that's the story. With the fire section and looking at the cook stoves, that was kind of the story, was that it was not at all what was being presented to the world.
Before I get back to the structure issue that I think you use so beautifully in the book, what's been a particularly, I mean, of all the sort of stories that you got, and you saw how people, you know, in small ways, but were having an impact on the ground, is there one or two, you know, really sort of successful practices that you'd like to talk about right now?
Yeah, I definitely feel like one of the most amazing aspects of what I saw in terms of having a real strong effect on the transforming a landscape was the water story, which I focused on Rajasthan, and the focus of the work of an organization called Tarun Bharat Sangh, which is started about 30 years ago by a man named Rajendra Singh, who is now known as the Rain Man of Rajasthan. He's ended up winning a lot of awards, but 30 years ago he was just nobody. He was just he was a Gandhian. He wanted to go out into the world, into the rural villages, and do good work. And as he tells the story, he wanted to start a hospital or something. And an old man in the village just said, "No, you know, we need water. That's what we need." All the wells had dried up. All of the men had left because the agriculture wasn't possible anymore. It wasn't possible to support livestock, and the men had basically left this region. And it was dying, basically, from lack of water. And the supposedly an old man told Rajendra Singh, "What we need is water, and the way that we get the water is we build little dams. We used to do this in the old days. We need to do it again. Build the dam." And so, as Rajendra tells it, this is what he did, and he started an organization that then, over the course of the past 25, 30 years, they've built thousands of dams in this Alwar district of Rajasthan. And what that ended up doing was that these monsoon rains come in such a fleeting, quick way that they would just, you know, the rains just run away. That's what the Indians say. They just come and they just run away, and they cause erosion in that process and removal of any topsoil that might be there. And instead, you build all these little dams to just make the water pause just enough that there's a chance for it to percolate down, recharge the river, recharge the groundwater systems. And what they found was that all these wells near the Sarvari River started springing back up to life. And what I saw there was a vibrant agricultural system, herds of goats, of, you know, somebody stopping their goat and filling up their cup and drinking it right there. I mean, it was the whole system seemed really like it had come back to life.
Great, great. And some parallels for us and our drought-stricken California.
A lot of parallels. Yeah. I saw, traveling around on this book tour, I have family in Texas, and I was there just a couple weeks ago talking with cousins there, and they're like, "Yep, we're having to drop the wells down, you know, they used to be 50 feet, now they're 400 feet. And this is like verbatim what I was hearing from farmers in Punjab. Like, I think a lot of these problems are just, I think there's a lot of information that could be shared both ways.
it's very important for the West to sort of keep a keen eye on some of the developments that are happening in terms of addressing environmental changes in India. I guess I'd like you to answer more, why should we care?
Right, right. Well, there is that whole, I mean, it's the second most populated country now. The UN new numbers say it's going to outpace China within 7 years. So we're looking at the most populous nation in the world. And it's the whole, you know, what happens in India doesn't stay in India. This is the, you know, I mean, this is an amazing thing about climate change. This is such a global problem. And when we talk about those two-thirds of households in India that are cooking over an open fire, that has not just a huge human health impact for mostly women who are leaning over those smoky stoves all day and the children that are next to them, but huge climate impact. There's actually this cloud over South Asia that is 2 miles thick, and a big part of it is coming from those sooty fires, and that is it's changing weather patterns throughout the entire region. So all of these problems just are gravitating out. So anything that, you know, we can do as a global community to help remedy some of these issues is going to benefit all of us. And agriculture too. Agriculture is changing with warming climate. The studies say that the yields are going to go down. So we're talking about, if we're concerned about food, we need to like tackle these other problems.
And this is a good entry point. Let's talk about what's going on with chemical pollution in India, and you know, just give us a little history of how it came about and where we are.
Yeah, I was focusing mostly on the chemical legacy of the Green Revolution, which was a method of farming that was introduced in the 60s to India that came from Western companies that was based on using hybrid seeds that were high yield crops, using it in conjunction with a whole package of fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and high quantities of water. So it was a system that addressed India's famine issues, which were very real to them, and not to be taken lightly, and not wanting to be repeated from as early as the early 1940s when millions died in Bengal. So India knew that it needed a growing population and it wanted to become independent from imports, and they were successful with that. They became food independent, but the 40, 50 years down the road, the realization of what costs came with that have become really apparent. So I focused mostly on Punjab, which is the breadbasket of India, talking about almost half of the rice from the country, a fifth of its wheat is all coming from this tiny little 1.5% of the land area. It's not a very big part of the country, right by Pakistan. And if the water table is in free fall, and the cancer rates there are higher than anywhere else in India, and there's nitrates in the water that remains. And it's just the yields did skyrocket with all those amazing inputs, but then they've sort of leveled out and sometimes gone down. And so the question of whether that land is just spent now because it's been asked to be working double time for half a century, and recognizing that that is just not, that cannot be sustained. I mean, they're talking about just not having potable water in Punjab in a decade or two, like very near future. So how, you know, I was looking at the farmers that were switching to organic as a way to try to start thinking about how can we farm for the long term.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful sort of scene in your book where a farmer reaches in and grabs soil from organic farming and has his smile, I'll let you tell it.
Gaura Singh, he was just wonderful. His mom asked him to switch to organic because she was sick, and she did end up dying. I have no idea if that has anything to do with the chemicals, but she was sick. She said, I believe that the chemicals are making me sick. Please start not using them. And he said, you know, I farmed with chemicals because I didn't know you couldn't. He was just in his 30s. That was all he'd ever known. And so he was like many of the millions of farmers in India. He was a small landholder. He only had about 5 acres. But when I met him, he had switched about half of them to organic. It's notable that he was keeping that half for his family and sending the rest to market. And he, I sat with him, and you know, among his corn stalks, and he just digs up the soil, and he just says, like, smell this. Like, like organic soil just smells so good. The chemical soil, it smells bad. And, you know, I'm smelling the soil and it has this just like rich aroma of life, like a mushroom, like it's alive. And his story, as much as I loved it, I wanted to go like find out what the science was behind that. And the science is there to support it. If you keep that soil alive, which if you're dousing it with chemicals, all the microorganisms go away. If you keep that soil alive, if you're not tilling it so that it builds up its tilth, then it can hold more water. It can store more carbon, which is another huge, huge thing we should be thinking about as we head to Paris and everywhere else, looking about how to mitigate climate change. And it just is more sustainable for the long term. There's all these benefits for why you should keep that soil alive so that it smells good when you hold it up.
So tell us about some of the challenges that of why more people aren't trying to do organic farming or what's sort of standing in the way of that progress.
Right, right. Part of it is just the mentality of, like he said, he just didn't know that he could do that. I mean, for farmers who have grown up, this system started in the 60s, so it's been a long time. I mean, I was meeting gray-haired farmers who were the ones who remember those first carts of free urea nitrogen fertilizer being given for free. That like looked like sugar to them because it was these big piles of white powder. But they're all graying now, so you have multiple generations that have only known this form of using chemicals. So it's a very, it seems very fringy to like think about giving that up to do this other thing. It seems risky to some farmers. And India is still working on really developing a solid market that would encourage farmers to just flat out get a much better price for their crops if they're grown organically, which is something that took a while for us to get in place here in the West as well. And so that's happening, and it's happening increasingly, which is encouraging. But that's another little hindrance. And then I mean, there's corporate influences. It's a $30 billion a year industry, the pesticides and the fertilizers. I mean, not to just always be picking on Monsanto, which a organic movement seems to target them, but they're spending, you know, millions of dollars a day on research, and those are costs that need to be recouped. So there's a lot of, you know, marketing that goes on to buy into this package approach to agriculture.
And in the case of Monsanto, it's not only for pesticides and fertilizer, but for seed.
For seed itself. And there, I mean, what's kind of encouraging is I was in a Society of Environmental Journalists conference in Nebraska just about a month ago, and, you know, this is, you know, heartland of America. Wasn't expecting to hearing much about sustainable farming techniques, and yet they were in the Dust Bowl. They're kind of facing that again with drought, and they were switching 20% of Oklahoma. Where did I say? Oklahoma. I was in Norman, Oklahoma. They were switching to no-till and showing, like, oh, look how much better the soil is. Like, the exact same things I was hearing from the farmers in Punjab. And I was also there, you know, there's tables there from the local companies. And they were encouraging, you know, trying to sell the things that are like the microorganisms that help build the soil. So they're getting into the marketing on, like, that organic side of things, which is, you know, maybe that's a step in the right direction. If they really want to sell something, at least it's something that's going to build the soil instead of deplete it.
And then, you know, Samira, what would you like to be the top three takeaways from people either here tonight or reading your book? You know, just the three points that you want to drive home
for
listeners.
Okay, let's see. I would say that they're everywhere. I experienced this in India, but I feel like it's happening everywhere, that there are really strong grassroots efforts of people who are trying to take control of their environment in their local community, and that there needs to be way more support for those efforts coming from the top that help have those be able to make traction and really make those gains. I would also say that another aspect that really came out from my research was just the power of the small. I called it the model of the micro. And India being a perfect place to implement this, small farmers, mom and pop shops. But that, you know, you can talk about building one gigantic canal to get water to someplace, or you can talk about a million little dams that all help have water stay where it lands. And so those small cumulative efforts can have a big effect. So let's push in that. And it also puts power back in people's hands. Yes. Instead of taking it away and saying, don't touch that, the engineers have it all under control, we'll report to you when it's available, and by the way, we'll tax you along the way, and it'll take 50 years to have it done, and all these big things are controversial, expensive, time-consuming. These smaller technologies are way more adaptable. And number three, I think just the fact that there's autonomy is given when people are also given that power to take control of their own lives. Part of the story also dealt with girls in a really pretty impoverished part of India and Bihar, and just a small bit of knowledge gives power, and then they start feeling like they have control, not only over their own bodies in this particular instance, but in other aspects of their life. And I feel like that kind of autonomy, when many people I was speaking to are people who are generally marginalized and dismissed as not having the ability to take control over their lives. Instead, it's somebody else from a nonprofit or some Western influence or something coming in saying, we've got the thing that will fix you. Like, no, people often know how to take care of themselves. That's if they get true. Support to do that.
You are listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. We're hearing from author and journalist Meera Subramanian. She's in conversation with Linda Calhoun, a trustee of the World Affairs Council. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to listen to our programs, to register to attend an upcoming event, or to become a council member. And now back to our conversation.
I've had you jump around in some of the examples that you use. So what I'd like to do is just go ahead and use the structure of the
right,
book.
Right, okay.
Tell what it was and tell how you used it to organize
the stories. Yeah, that's true. We've been kind of talking about it without explaining. So the basic structure that I took for the book was using the five elements. And the idea of elements is a very cross-cultural, across-time. Humans, I think, have wanted to define what it is that this world that we inhabit. And so I focused on the Panchamahabhuta, which is the Sanskrit Hindu cosmology of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. So I use that as the structure of the book. Each of those elements, I would zero in on something. So earth was the organic agriculture, water was these water restoration efforts, fire was the wood cook stoves and how to deal with the fact that so many people are cooking over open fires. Air was the vulture's decline story, and then ether, I wanted to address the issue of population, and that's where I looked at reproductive and sexual health training with teenagers in Bihar.
And talk a little bit more about that.
That was a really fascinating story to work on, just because I talked to so many people who were...
And just for a second, to set the stage again, population impacts... that are happening in India.
In India, yeah. And in terms of that this is one of the main pressures on natural resources is the fact that there are a lot of humans to feed, and there are a lot of humans to make sure that they have adequate water and adequate housing and adequate education. And so that was part of why I focused on India, even with this book, was not just my own personal connection to India through my father, but just that it seems like a good place to be looking. How is India dealing with this collision of population pressures with natural resources? What are they doing right? What are they doing wrong? What can we all be learning looking at this example? Because arguably what they're facing is what we're all going to be facing in the decades to come, if we're not maybe already facing it in some respects now.
What can India and the U.S. learn from each other? I mean, what is the main exchange that we should be having?
Yeah, I mean, I think more than anything, it needs to be, it needs to just be a two-way street of discussion. I think there is an element of Western, you know, a lot of the population nonprofits that I was looking at in Bihar were Western funded. And so they were run by Indians, but they were receiving their funding, which makes them very vulnerable. And in India, wants to be autonomous. They want to be able to do those things themselves, and they are. But then there's an angle of. I mean, it's been problematic where some of the nonprofits have been booted out of India in recent time, like just in the past year since Prime Minister Modi was elected into power. And so there's this sense like, we can do it ourselves. But then when I watch how Prime Minister Modi has been, what development methods he's been pushing forward over the past year, mm-hmm. they seem to be just repeats of the colonial model of like mega development, rage forward. And as I worked on this book, I'm just like, oh, this is a missed opportunity. Like, India could form a new model of development for the 21st century that doesn't look like the last century's model. The last century's model was mega dams and big coal-fired power plants. And we saw, you know, we've seen what the cost of that is. Sure, let's build all the coal-fired power plants and get that electricity to people, and then we know exactly what the skies will look like. Right. They will look like London in the 1800s, and they'll look like Beijing yesterday, and they'll look like New Delhi today, which now has the worst air pollution in the world. So we know what that looks like, and it's almost like what's been happening in the past year, like Prime Minister Modi is like colonizing himself. And so I argue in the book for an eco-Swaraj. Swaraj is self-rule. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which Gandhi helped India achieve from the Brits. It's like, we can do this. We're an amazing country with amazing resources. We can do this. So I'm arguing for eco-Swaraj. I want to see India create some new model of development. And then in terms of getting back to your question about what does the U.S. learn, we've got a crumbling infrastructure. There's no indications that Congress wants to invest in a new deal to rebuild it. Maybe there are ways that this micro scale of development can happen in India that could be a model for places like us.
That's fantastic. Great.
Maybe.
Fingers crossed. We've received quite a few questions from our audience. I could talk to you all night. I'm
okay.
curious about
Quick
all
answers.
Of these things. No, we have some time here. And this first one is, how does India's religious and cultured traditions play into how individuals interact with the environment? And this person talks about the example being the pollution of the Ganges River, and he's read that people, or she has read that people don't worry about it, and that the Ganges is a god, and therefore it's impossible for mere mortals to hurt it.
There's no easy way to answer the question about how religion influences, because while we think of India as a Hindu nation for the most part, it isn't. There are all these other religions that are there playing out. There's tribal traditional religions. There's Muslims. There's Parsis. There's Christians. Everybody is in India. It's a very, very diverse nation, which I think is easy to forget. And so like, there's no easy answer to that. I definitely have seen both sides of that equation. I've definitely seen that it's true that some body of water can be so holy that nothing, like the questioner phrased it, like nothing humans could do could ever sully such waters. But then there is the converse of that, where they do recognize that there is a lack of respect for that. And I would meet
stewardship.
Yeah, the stewardship part. And what I loved about reporting on this for so long and traveling everywhere is I met people in the most surprising places, you know, like I would plunk down in a hotel lobby to catch up on Wi-Fi and work there for hours, and then, you know, eventually the waiters would be like, what are you doing? Who are you? And I would tell them, and they're just like, yes, you know, there's a water leak out in the back, and we have to not waste water. It's important that, you know, like, and then somebody who I would least expect to be thinking about the environment was gravely concerned about it. And it was like, that happened all the time, all over the place. And so I feel like it is not unlike here or anywhere else, where there's never any clear lines where you can just say all these people care and all these people don't. Even when we say, you know, the red states don't care about the environment and the blue states do, that's a totally false dichotomy. And I experienced that in India too.
Do you feel that the family you were born into in India will still deny you a job as it did, say, 50 or 100 years ago? And if so, do you think the government can help with this? Or is it just something that will happen?
I feel like that is changing. It's still deeply embedded within Indian culture, but I do feel like it's changing. And I was feel like I came across it the most with the water restoration story, because that Those efforts were being done only when the entire village had buy-in to build the little dams within their village, mm-hmm. and every household had to represent. And so with projects like that, you had people working side by side, and it crossed caste divisions, that they were actually working together.
Oh, okay.
And that sounded like the villagers were really responding to that. And then there's a huge midday meal lunch program in India, and I haven't reported on that directly, but I've heard that that has been a place also where sharing food is something that is there's a strong caste distinction where you're not supposed to do that, and these kids are doing that and growing up with that. And so I've heard that that has some effects as well.
And then, so if a U.S. citizen wants to have some impact in terms of aiding individuals who are taking these initiatives in India, is there anything that we can do to support that? I mean, this writer talks about issues like farmer suicides and local Indian challenges.
Yeah, I would... I guess I would mostly encourage supporting the Indian organizations that are working on this. Mm. I feel like there are a lot.
Can you name some names?
I mean, I was impressed with the Tarun Bharat Sangh was the name of the organization that was doing the water work in Rajasthan. And since the dams and the water restoration in that area had really taken effect, they've been working a lot with the Ganga cleanup, with the Ganges cleanup. So they're focusing on efforts. The Kativarasat Mission was an organization that was doing a lot of the training for organic farmers there. I looked a little bit at Navdanya's work, which is Vandana Shiva's organization, and they seem to be having some good bridging between farmer and market with organics, and actually helping create that market so that the farmers were getting 10% more for their organic produce than if they weren't using that system. So those are a few. I have plans to get a nice resource list on my website, but it just has not happened yet. But hopefully,
maybe after the book tour. Maybe after the book tour. And then this next question is, can you talk about the role of skills training like that done by Barefoot College in teaching individuals how to solve environmental problems? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I'm familiar. They seem to be doing good work. I have never reported on them directly, so I don't know. I don't know firsthand, but that seems like a model. I mean, my understanding is they're like training, I think, mostly women. Is that right? Does anybody know? I think it's mostly training women to do things like, you know, install solar systems into the villages, and so like they're basically giving them engineering skills and marketing skills, and I think anything you can do to help with the situation of women plays out. The Millennium Development Goals, it's amazing how many of those circle back to women's issues, and I was struck by that with this book, where I was not approaching stories in that way, but then realizing just how much that came into play. I was thinking, oh, that'll come into play with ether when I'm talking about reproductive and sexual health, but talking about cook stoves, it's women who are collecting all of that biomass. It's women who are starting and, you know, sitting over those smoky stoves every day, and it's fundamentally a women's issue, and getting them improved cook stoves, if the men are controlling the finances of the house, they can think of many other things to do with money besides buy their wife a stove. So it was amazing how much, so anything that can be done to empower and educate women is a step forward.
Great. And getting back to the cook stove for one second, let's talk about the stat that I saw from the World Health Organization. I mean, the magnitude of this problem is that...
Yeah, so the Global Burden of Disease Studies is this huge meta-study. They bring in so many scientists to look at basically what is killing and sickening humans across the planet. And the most recent numbers were just staggering around the impact from these biomass stoves being used in the home. And it's 4 million deaths a year, which, to put in context, is more than malaria and tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS combined. So we hear a lot about tackling those other issues, but just not very much about these, you know, we're building these little volcanoes that emit all these really harmful pollutants in homes every day, every single day that these women are cooking over these stoves. I mean, I walked into some homes and I you know, they were okay. I guess they were used to it, but I walked in and I couldn't be a journalist. I couldn't ask them anything because my voice was just gone. I just, I could not breathe. And I heard scientists who were doing stove work say the same thing. Like, oh, we wanted to, you know, we had our data sensors and everything, and we decided to plug the air hole in the roof so that we could replicate, you know, monsoon seasons. And they're like, oh, that didn't work. We couldn't stay in there to do the testing equipment. Like, it was really, it's amazing how harmful it is. You can tell it is.
So that's in the rural areas. And this questioner wants to know, what kind of sustainable methods are used in India's cities now, and which of these methods are going to increase in usage? So you've talked a lot about what's going on rurally.
What about the cities? You're right. I didn't really mean to, but I ended up focusing a lot on the rural areas. In the cities, some of the encouraging things that were happening in cities, especially is around rainwater catchment systems, they're starting to figure out that they need to just implement that into any new building. Like Chennai is making a lot of great advances on that, where they're just, again, it's the exact same thing that was happening in the rural scene, where instead of just the water coming down, hitting the streets, and running out to sea and becoming lost, instead getting that water to drain back directly into the ground and help recharge those aquifers that are under cities. So that was one of the most encouraging things that I saw in the urban environment.
Now, you talked about what was going on in terms of local agencies in India addressing some of these challenges. This questioner wants to know, are there successful outside organizations that have been supporting the work?
Yeah, definitely. I spoke to a lot of different organizations when I was researching the ether section around the reproductive and sexual mm-hmm. health. And so mm-hmm. I talked to many organizations in Bihar. Some of them were Indian-based, and some of them were outside. And Pathfinder International, which is a U.S.-based organization, was the one that I ended up focusing on just because they did seem like they were doing the most solid, effective work that I saw.
And now this questioner, and it speaks to what you're going to be dealing with and dealt with in the book, talked about infrastructure challenges in India. Can you talk about, being that, you know, there are some serious challenges, can you talk about what your experience was? I mean, you had to get around all over.
India's infrastructure has definitely improved. They have a rail system that exceeds ours by light years. You can get almost anywhere in the country by rail cheaply, which is both of those, you know, both getting to certain places and getting there cheaply is something that I love Amtrak, but they have not achieved in this country. So in that way, they have been really good. They are developing roads. There's a whole big, I forget it has a name for this triangular system that's connecting major cities. That's going into place. There have been some efforts, like I mentioned, the subway earlier in Delhi that have been implemented to try to make that a little more sustainable, because like the number of new vehicles that are going onto Indian roads as the middle class rises, that's one of the first things that families are getting, and that's causing huge amounts of the traffic is just unbelievable in the cities and everywhere in India. And so they're trying to do some metro subway systems, but they're, like I said, having just a hard time keeping up with the demand. But the demand is there, so that's really encouraging. I think the place in terms of thinking about infrastructure and trying to think about it differently that really struck me with the book was just the potential of microgrid systems that are based on renewables. Like the fact that the electric grid is still so lacking in India mm-hmm. in some ways offers kind of a blank slate. So maybe getting a full electric grid everywhere is not the direction India needs to go. It's the comparison to telephone lines, right? In India, you used to have to get on a waiting list for a landline, and you might wait 1 or 2 years to get your phone hooked up. So cell phones, when those came in, Indians snapped them up like immediately, because oh my god, like skip the 2-year waiting line, you get a phone, and then you're building cell phone towers, and you don't need to build the landlines anymore. Right. They become obsolete. And so microgrids could do that same thing. And the most encouraging things I heard at like some conferences and different researchers who I spoke to was just the idea of these microgrid systems that are standalone systems that can be put into place really quickly, really pretty cheaply, and but are also made to basically be able to tap into an infrastructure of an electric grid if and when the time comes, because the battery storage issue is always like the most mm-hmm. problematic of the renewable systems. But if you build it so it's adaptable to like stand alone, but be ready to tap into that larger structure, that could be a whole different model for development.
That's fantastic. And now this questioner wants to know, Mira, you know, as resources become more scarce with increasing population, and things like resources like water that cross borders, and rivers that are originate in Nepal mm-hmm. that are depleted or polluted before reaching India. What are you seeing in terms of these sort of transnational tensions? Can you talk about
that? It's hugely problematic. I mean, there are already major water wars going on in India between states and then between countries that are already way too volatile. Like, mm-hmm. we don't want to be pushing those water wars. And that's, again, where I think that the micro scale of water management has a lot more potential and also a lot less potential blowback to pursue these smaller scale things, because the all of the interlinking river projects, in terms of just talking about massively moving water from one part of the country to another, which if undertaken will be the largest engineering feat on the face of the earth. I mean, they're talking about major, major large scale movement of water, but problematic in terms of the political side and potentially extremely volatile. And dangerous. Some of those like mega dam projects that also are playing into that, the ones that would be most effective in terms of like, you know, nice steep canyon where you can put a big fat dam and get really, those are in seismically active mm-hmm. Himalayan regions that are really just potentially physically dangerous in terms of structure and building them. And there's a lot of displacement of marginalized human communities as well in that process.
You know, Amira, this question is talking about tone and how developed countries should be addressing countries like India in terms of development and environmental concerns. And I guess this is, you know, really timely as we're looking at COP. Mm-hmm. What's your advice in terms of the right tone to take, you know, from a country or from countries that have already had their improved living
right.
standards
right.
having sullied the air and the water, and now they're telling, you know, a developing country that has such severe need.
Yeah, India, it bristles at that, as they should. We are the ones who are still the biggest emitter of carbon, so we... And we do not have the, you know, our population is a fraction of it. Like, there are many reasons why we really do need to be the ones who are stepping up more than the developing countries. But at the same time, I would argue that just like that whole new model of development, India, I would hope, would want to take the ownership of saying, watch this, watch what we can do. We can develop, and we can do it without doing what you guys did, which was so bad, instead of just saying, we're going to do what you guys did, which was so bad, because it's our turn. Instead of saying that, do something spectacular and create a new model of development that can like work for longer than 50 years, because we hopefully want to be on this planet living, you know, not in a completely and utterly transformed world for more than 50 years.
Right, right. I mean, the stakes are high.
The stakes are extremely high.
And we don't have transit to Mars yet.
Not yet.
And we only have time for one more question.
Okay.
And I will take the moderator's privilege of asking you that question.
Okay.
And, you know, Mira, I'm struck by, you know, you talked in your book about going to India as a child. And the sort of your journey here as an American in the U.S., you know, wanting to go to Oregon and sort of live on the land, and then, you know, go and report on and being drawn to individuals who are doing the same sort of thing.
Right.
You know, how are you sort of integrating all of those experiences? I mean, when you made that first trip to India, I don't know how old you were. Did you ever envision that you would be doing the work that you're doing now?
I think it definitely imprinted on me in strange ways. I mean, when I was my first trip, I was 18 months old. I don't remember that one. But when I went when I was 10, which seems like such a magical age to take kids to travel, like they're old enough to kind of take care of themselves, but they're young enough to not be like a brat. Like I went when I was 13, and I just kind of wanted to be home with my friends and stuff. But like 10 was just such a I was just so wide-eyed about it, and I was just so fascinated about what I was seeing. And it was the first time I'd really experienced seeing kids that were extremely hungry, you know, asking my mom, like, well, if they're hungry, why are they so fat? And she's like, that's a distended belly, that's not fat. And so you just really eye-opening experiences at a really kind of vulnerable age for that, informative age for that. And so I ended up going back again when I was like a teenager, and then when I was 19, I did a semester at sea program, which was a travel program through University of Pittsburgh. And so that was just traveling all over the world, and that was when I became environmentally aware in terms of just seeing like the impact of humans on resources everywhere in those travels, and really being able to compare, like they're harvesting little tiny fish, in the Philippines because that's all that's there. All the big fish are gone, and looking at all these like questions of sustainability there. And then I went to India on that trip, and that was the first time I went on my own without the cushion of my immediate family. And so then also I just started like seeing India as a college student who was reading and learning about these things and questioning these issues of the environment and seeing it all in a new light. So that all those things just kind of built one upon the other. But I think seeing the lack of materialism that I experienced in India as a child, that I feel like that's kind of changed as India has become globalized. But when I was a kid, it was just about family and food and very relaxed time and everything else. And that I think that made an impression on me at that point.
And you always felt welcomed?
I did. I felt very, very deeply loved. My grandparents were not in support of my parents' marriage when it happened, and it was a struggle for my family for my dad to incorporate us, so that he stayed diligently dedicated to maintaining a connection to his family there and making sure we had a connection. And that played out. Once there were kids and we all went and visited, then it was like, oh, everything's fine. Your mother, she's 150% Indian. So I have a wonderful, strong connection with my family there, which has really made my life richer.
And then as you were traveling around also, did you feel some sense of, yeah, I belong here?
Yeah, I have this like one foot in India. You know, I have known it all my life, and my blood is from there. Even if I was born and raised here, even if I do not speak the language, you know, better than a 2-year-old, but I do have a strong, a deep love of the country and deep connection to the country, that hopefully translated that I cared about what I was trying to report respectfully while I was there.
Very much so, Mira. Well, that's all that we have time for this evening. And on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Mira Subramanian for this excellent discussion. And many thanks to you, the audience, for your terrific questions. And so with that, thank you and good night, everyone.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode was author and journalist Mira Subramanian, and she was in conversation with Linda Calhoun, trustee of the World Affairs Council. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to listen to our programs, to register for an upcoming event, or to become a council member. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is David Ogilvie. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.